Will come to order. We have a number of matters on our agenda for today, and I'd like to proceed with them expeditiously. If we can, I'm going to go to the very end of the agenda first and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 697, and we'll hear a summary and then from Senator Morris.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 697A allows the county assessor to reduce the maximum assessed value of property when buildings are demolished or removed from the premises. Under current law, when a property is destroyed or damaged by fire or by an act of God, that is when the maximum assessed value can be adjusted downward. This bill will revise that to allow it to occur when the buildings are demolished as well.
And do we have a revenue statement?
Yes, we do, but it's a very weak one. I will say that based on the probability, it's a what we call like a negligible one, a very small one, based on the probability that it's mostly going to be negative, because if a property is demolished, the assumption is that it would reduce the amount of value.
All right. Has that been distributed to the committee? I don't have it in my file.
Yes. It should be.
Yes.
An impact statement?
Yesterday. All right. Well, I don't have it. Would you see that I get one?
Yes.
And other members who may be lacking it as well.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, State Senator, name is Frank Morris, from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. This is a bill that has emerged with a unanimous vote off of the floor of the Senate. And as has been described, when you have an improvement that has been removed by an act of God, the taxes go down. If it's removed by the owner, the taxes will not go down. In fact, they will stay as if that improvement was in place. And this came to my attention during the interim meeting with our Benton County assessor, and he raised this issue and shared with me a tax court decision, and I would like to just reference the findings from the court on this issue. And I quote, "Plaintiff finds the disparity in the law between a building destroyed by fire and one voluntarily raised by the owner to be decidedly unfair and illogical. The court agrees that there is room for improvement in the governing law. However, any changes would have to come from the legislature and not the court." And in this case, the magistrate found in favor of the defendant and not the plaintiff. So that gives rise to this legislation, and let's correct the illogical, unfair nature of this small part of the tax code, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Morris. Questions for Senator Morris? Your sense of this is that this is one of those situations where prayer may not be enough.
Well, I'm not just sure how to take that, Mr. Chair.
Well, acts of God are covered, but voluntary act on the part of the owner isn't.
Right.
Thank you. The Revenue Committee Chair should never attempt a joke. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 697?
Thank you.
I don't see anyone. And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill, or Senate Bill 697. I have to learn how to say that now. Okay. And it's interesting. I just was handed pieces of... Oh, yeah, there it is. Mary, are you satisfied that this is an accurate statement of the cost?
We're saying that the probability is more negative than positive. If you demolish something, we're saying you're going to lose some assessed value. And under current law, if it's a building that should be removed, and it's there at its maximum assessed value because it cannot be, the value cannot be lowered, then there's going to be some loss in revenue. But as to how much, during the Senate hearings, there was some suggestion that in some cases when a defective building is removed, the assessed value on what's left goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you've got this plus and minus, and I can't put a number on it. It's so it's so that's why it's negligible to the negative side.
Thank you.
Is the treasurer here? Do you see her?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Could I speak to this bill? Just.
Oh, yes. We'll reopen.
You closed it?
On Senate Bill 697, please.
Yes. I have been in this situation, and I can tell you what's going to happen is the assessed value is going to go back up in a hurry. You're taking down an old building, and you're replacing it more often than not with a new one. And in the end, the counties are going to benefit because what you're taking down is something ugly and awful, and what you're replacing it with is something much better and at a higher value. So I would suggest this is a very good idea.
Thank you. And is that mechanically how it actually works?
If a person removes a
small old building on a lot now and then builds a larger structure, one assumes that that the new structure is assessed at current value subject to Measure 50 and Measure 5, and most likely it's worth more at the end than before you remove the older structure.
That is correct. So if you could estimate what those changes would be, it would be positive, but you can't anticipate what that
is. The only time this really counts, then, is in situations where a structure is removed or reduced, perhaps, and it isn't replaced with something more valuable.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Hence the relatively small fiscal effect on the property tax receivers. All right. Are we ready to close the public hearing? We are. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 697. And we will open public hearing on Senate Bill 66. Who's on that one?
The Treasurer and the Secretary of State.
That's the reason I opened.
Yeah.
Masson?
Yes, afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 66 is two-thirds of 666.
Economists aren't allowed to make jokes either.
You are a trouble.
That's a good one, Mr. Chair. Okay, comes to you from your Senate counterpart. We had this bill in Senate Finance and Revenue. Senate Bill 66 does a few things. It, first of all, started with a cleanup of how the state treasurer deals with some accounts that used to be or that used to reside in the general fund, and they take those out and allow them to be distinct for the purpose of managing the general fund and managing those different accounts differently. And then this also allows for the amendment that occurred in the Senate, allows for the electric public service fund as well as low income them to be taken out of the general fund and to be an investment process. And what else do we have? I think Senate Bill 66 is that management. That management process needs to be. That's about it. I mean, also one more thing, Mr. Chair, that happens at last session. There was within the process of the budget, a number of elected offices were put under the structure of the governor's budget, and the. Because of the difficulty of how these processes would work within the budget process and within the independence of the elected offices, this bill allows for those offices and these elected officials to be outside of the governor's budget and budgeting process and puts them back to how the statute is used to treat those budgets in the past. So it reversed this occurrence that happened last session.
And thank you. And by coincidence, we have today with us the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer. Would you come forward? Yes. Thank you so much for being here today.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill Bradbury, Secretary of State. I think it would be very appropriate to have the Treasurer start, so this was really mostly his bill.
I think that's a great idea.
But I support a little piece of it. I'm a very strong supporter of a little piece of it.
I thought you were going to start this off. All right. Well, again, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. And actually, Darren Bond from my staff can give you some of the other components of the bill. But Bill and I are here to talk about the one aspect of the bill that your staff described, which is to change back, which we believe is an important balance of power between the governor and our two offices. What happened at the end of last session, on the last day of session, during the Christmas tree bill, there was a change made to definitionally put Bill's office and my office under the governor for budgetary purposes. And it's we didn't find this out until months after the legislature left. And when we found it, we immediately talked to the governor and said, we've got an issue here. And really, the issue is fundamentally one of an accountability. We're three constitutional officers. I think Bill and I are proud to say we work with the governor, but not for the governor. And that really is the difference here. And in essence, our offices have historically always budgeted independent of the governor, per se, and have worked, though, with DAS to make sure we're complying with many of the rules that they have. But we work parallel. And then we come to you to talk to you about our budget and our needs independent of the governor. And so what we're asking is a very slight change to back to way the history of these offices have been, which is to keep the three elected statewide constitutional officers independent of each other, if you will, and to be held accountable to you and to be held accountable to the voters of Oregon. That really is what this is, this slight change in definition, which takes us back to where we were before. And I encourage you to support this. This bill was unanimously passed by the Senate, and Bill and I made the same presentation there as well, and it was well received. So anyway, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or maybe let Bill add on to that.
I just would say absolutely ditto. And I think the key issue here is the way it has been for 150 years, whatever it is, since statehood has been the way it was until the very end of last session, and then it was changed at the very end of last session. And both the Treasurer and I feel very strongly that it's not appropriate to have another constitutional officer basically having control over our budget. We're very comfortable to bring our budgets to you. You're the ones that make the decisions about budgets, and that's the way it should be. We're more than happy to be responsible to the people of the state and obviously bring our budgets forward to the legislature. And I think it's important to emphasize that there's certainly no big disagreement between the three offices right now. I think that in the long run, we need to make sure that we can keep it that way on a budgetary basis, regardless of who's sitting in any of these chairs. Mm-hmm. So I support the proposal.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Berger.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, if you'll indulge me. And I don't mean to be... First question is, where do you know the sections that do this? Where in the bill?
I don't have a copy of the
bill. If you don't know, somebody else will, and
okay,
I'll
we'll
ask
get
later.
Somebody
okay.
Up there. Right. We can show you.
The second question is...
you can ask your staff. Though.
Yeah.
Representative, it's actually section 11, where we remove the definition of state officer
okay.
in that section, and because state officer would then include the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer under the definition. And if you take that out, then it
okay.
no longer is covered.
That helps. That helps me as to what the language is. Then I guess this, then my second question makes more sense, which is why is it in this bill?
Well, I guess I can answer that. We had introduced this bill, pre-session filed, if I'm not mistaken, and we saw this was a bill relating to this office that we could then add it into and talk about. We could have done a freestanding bill, but it made sense to put it, since it was something germane to my office and finance, it made a lot of sense to put it here.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Thank you. Other questions? Yeah, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is such a perfect picture moment. I mean, if you think about it, I'm thinking about this.
That's because Darren joined us. Is that?
Well, actually, I was thinking before. You know. My question is:
sure.
Representative Gelser and I heard Bill in the Human Services and Women's Wellness last week over on down the far end of the building, and it dealt with. House Bill 3016, which helps protect the money set aside from sale of the former damaged hospital property housing with chronic mental illnesses. And that bill separates the Community Housing Trust account from the Community Mental Health Housing Fund. My question then is, do you see Senate Bill 66 here having any impact on the new trust account or the transfer?
Actually, Darren, do you have a comment? I don't have a comment. I don't think it would impact it, but
For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the State Treasury, and I believe we have someone here from DHS who's going to speak specifically to that. But no, I believe the result from this bill will be to allow the damage funds to be able to earn additional income from the current, from the way their language is currently stated in statute.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. My recollection from sitting on another committee is that that your budgets, as a practical matter, this year were handled by simply having the governor receive them and pass them along in his budget statement. So there wasn't a problem this year. In another year, when the governor and the other statewide office holders weren't on such cordial terms, I could imagine that might be more problematic, and hence the value in a bill like this. I'm getting head nods. Thank you. That's all I need.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It's really been really maintaining the history and independence of these offices, regardless of who the three of us are, and it's a check and balance. And this moved the needle away from that. And I think what we're trying to do is put it back to where it was. Pretty simple.
Thank you. Anything further for these two, and then we'll hear from Mr. Bond. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the State Treasurer. I get the mundane part of the bill. The Senate Bill 66A originally was our housekeeping bill. The main thing that it does is correct some statutory language relative to interest retention in accounts. It also moves some accounts, as Mazin indicated, out of the general fund that shouldn't be there to begin with. Current law has two distinct conventions when it comes to establishing accounts that are able to retain interest. One is where you've given the authority for the account to retain interest. The other convention speaks to the investment of the monies. We believe that those two distinct conventions are, in fact, distinct and have meaning. Recently, the question's been raised as to whether or not, given the Treasurer's broad discretion, there is a clear distinction, and it might be a gray area. Well, we prefer to not have gray areas when it comes to the statutes we work under, and this change in Section 2 will provide that clear distinction, so that unless you say the Treasurer can invest the monies and you simply say interest can be retained in the account, we'll treat that account more like an interest-bearing checking account, and we'll manage it very conservatively through the Oregon Short-Term Fund. Should you tell us the funds can be discreetly invested, we would have the option at the Treasurer's discretion, given the criteria that he's established and the nature of the funds, to set up a more discreet portfolio that potentially captures more yield for that. The damaged endowment funds are a perfect example of when that makes sense. Section 7 of the bill is where the damage related to the damage funds of the Community Housing Trust are dealt with. We support it. It's an endowment. It makes every bit of sense to be able to treat it. It's a sizable enough amount for us to address. So that's reasonable, and I believe someone will speak to that momentarily. Section 10 of the bill is legislative council initiated cleanup, where definitions in 291 are simply being reordered because Legislative Council likes to have them in an order different than they
I'm
are
sorry,
now.
I'm sorry, which section?
Section 10.
10, thank you.
This language is moved around in the bill, but none of the language has changed. Section 11 and the repeal of ORS 291-230 were discussed by the Treasurer and the Secretary of State. Section 12 of the bill repeals ORS 291-280, which addresses or calls for duplicate receipts to be provided by Treasury to DAS. We don't provide any receipts to DAS. It's predicated on a paper-based era. Now all of our interfaces are electronic. We deliver them electronic information throughout the day, as we do with other state agencies. This is simply removing some archaic language. The remaining sections of the bill address the issue of accounts that were set up in the general fund that retain interest. Accounts, if they're going to retain interest, shouldn't be set up in the general fund. There's no cash flow benefit to the general fund. There's no income benefit to the general fund. It creates reporting and accounting headaches for my staff, and we're simply cleaning that up. And that's the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions on it.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bond? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who... Oh, there are. There is one other signed up. Bob Miller?
Yeah, sure. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Miller. I'm the Evidence-Based Practices Manager for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 66. With Senate Bill 66, one of the things that it does, Section 7 makes possible a discrete investment of monies to earn the highest possible interest. The interest earned is used by the Addictions and Mental Health Division for the development of housing for persons with serious mental illness. In earlier testimony, House Bill 3016 was mentioned. We don't believe that anything in Senate Bill 66 will interfere with the arrangements being developed under 3016. So we strongly support this bill and believe it will help us provide additional resources for the seriously mentally ill. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Miller? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak in the public hearing on Senate Bill 66? If not, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 66. Colleagues, is this ready to work, or do you want another day to review it?
It's ready?
All right. Let's open the work session on Senate Bill 66. Colleagues, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gelson.
I would move Senate Bill 66A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelson moves Senate Bill 66, A and Gross, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Oh, right. Well, thank you. Paul reminds me that it has a subsequent Ways and Means that it no longer needs. And so one of the things we'll want to address is removal of the subsequent. Do you want to amend your motion?
Yes, please. Mr. Chair, I would move that the prior referral to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 66A be rescinded and that the bill be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gelser moves Senate Bill 66A and Gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a removal of the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Further discussion? Well, that was quick. Please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Rip.
Excused.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
See?
We.
Aye.
I vote yes. Again, I'm being punished for my attempt at a joke earlier. I appreciate it, committee. With that, Senate Bill 66 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a removal of the subsequent referral of Ways and Means. Is there any reason why this shouldn't go on the consent calendar? It's a big issue, but it doesn't look to me like it's any controversy.
I would disagree, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to carry it if you like, but this is the kind of thing that's going to raise questions.
Okay.
Because it has pretty big implications and it's pretty complicated.
Thank you. You're ready to carry it?
I will be willing to carry it.
Representative Berger.
That's why I'm carrying so many bills, because I don't like the consent calendar.
Representative Berger, we'll carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 66. Thank you. Is the treasurer still here? Oh, he is. He's just moved. Okay. All right. We're going to open a hearing on his other bill. That is Senate Bill 579. Is that yours too? No? No? Thank you. Paul.
I'll be back.
All right. So we'll get Paul to give us a summary.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 579. Modifies the definition for which for management of the Oregon Growth Account. The Oregon Growth Account receives 10%. It's within the Education Stability Fund and receives 10% of the revenue flowing into that fund. And it's an account that's been designed to invest in emerging business in Oregon. And what this bill does is change the types of businesses that are eligible. And the main change is to delete references, and you can see that in the bill, deletes references to traded sector. As you recall, traded sector is really economic development language for those sectors that are going to be selling products or services outside the state. And there is a definition in statute for what those sectors are. They tend to be goods-producing sectors, although they're not always goods-producing. And what this bill does is give the managers of the account more flexibility so that they don't have to have the traded sector requirement. It also changes some other language. And for example, you can see the use of under Section 1 there, sub 4, it adds a seed capital for technology, for example. And it also provides a little bit more flexibility on page 2 under Section 3 for the type of agreements that the Oregon Growth Board should contract with, expanding the partnership allowances for managing those funds.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. Oh, yes. And Representative Berger.
You can go first.
No, Mr. Treasurer, you will.
It's your committee. I'm just visiting. Go ahead.
Members of the committee, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, and I will be brief because I did not intend to preempt the State Treasurer on this. I only want to bring to your attention that this is a bill under the Oregon Inc. banner. Oregon Inc. was how I spent my interim. And in case you don't recall, it is a group called together by the last legislature of basically business and higher ed folks to bring forward a strategic, I'm struggling for words here because I was surprised to be here today, a strategic plan basically for innovation in Oregon and seeding sort of an innovation economy, if I could describe it that way. There are a package of bills going through in an effort to further this.
This is one small piece of it. It has to do with how we use the Oregon Growth Account and making it sort of part of the seed package for Oregon, Inc. The treasurer can speak better, I think, to this particular bill, but I wanted to bring your attention that this is part of this bigger package and an important part of it. And if you want more on Oregon, Inc., I could go on and on, but I think rather than that, let's have you ask questions if you have any about this, and let the treasurer explain exactly this piece.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, again, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, and I'm proud to testify before the UN today. After that last vote, everybody was indulging in their different languages. I want to thank the committee for their support for this Senate Bill 66A and that change. This bill, Senate Bill 579, as Representative Berger described, is part of a legislative package being brought before the legislature from the Oregon Innovation Council, which I'm a member of. And I won't give you a long history of that group, but in essence, it was an effort by the legislative body last year to consolidate a lot of different interests that were trying to do the right thing for Oregon, which is to look for opportunities to invest and grow ideas in the state, particularly at our universities, and to coordinate both with the public sector and the private sector. There are a number of people in the private sector, not only who led this effort, David Chin being one of them, but others that help support this effort, along with Representative Berger, some other members of the legislature, and myself. So this has been there is a package out there, and I would ask that you do support this package. There's some good things in it. This bill is very simple in that it expands the focus and the opportunity by which the Oregon Growth Account can look for investments in Oregon. And I think Representative Berger framed it right. This really gives me the flexibility. And by the way, I am the chair of the Oregon Growth Account. And this group is charged to finding opportunities to invest in Oregon that can help grow those ideas and businesses. What this will do is give me and my board more latitude to look at earlier stage investments, seed stage investments, as is known in the investment world. And what it will do, it will help me complement some of the work that's being done already at our universities, whereby we're trying to help grow those ideas in our universities. It gives my board more latitude statutorily to do that. The traded sectors, again, I think the change and deletion of there is to say that there are a lot of ideas that are not yet in the traded sector, so hence gives us that freedom to do that. This has been supported by the Oregon Innovation Council. I think somebody from the Software Association will speak in support of this bill as well. And again, I'm pleased that we have this opportunity to sit at the table with this group, because they really have been working very hard, very long, to keep finding opportunities in the state. This is a small way in which, through my office and the Oregon Growth Account, we can play a role in that. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for either of our panelists today? This is an account that was set up when? Just last time, wasn't it?
Actually, the Oregon Growth Account was set up in 1995, if I remember.
Okay.
And there's a long history, if you will, in what is the Oregon Growth Account, but there was a previous mixture of letters that it used to be, and it was a group that made direct investments in Oregon. It ran into a constitutional problem because these are state monies, and there's a prohibition that does not allow the state to invest in companies. There was a fix, and then hence the Oregon Growth Account. There was a constitutional change, and therefore it allowed us to operate as we do, for example, the trust monies that we do, the PERS funds, et cetera, so we have the ability to own equity positions in companies.
Okay, and if I understand it correctly, this the Oregon Growth Account currently is a portion of the Education Stability Fund.
Correct.
And
we get a certain percentage of the money that's directed there to this fund. We get about $2 million, roughly a quarter.
In effect, what we're talking about is targeted investments.
Correct.
Made by the treasurer, or the
this board.
The board.
And let me be clear, the way we've structured this, and this is the way we've been successful in money, in running money, investing money, is to leverage the money that we have. That is, find partnerships that are out there doing this, so that we're not the only ones taking the sole risk. Although I would say, if you look at this language, there's more flexibility to find, individuals or groups that we may not know who exist today because of the constraints we have. So, it should help us. I can't, you know, promise the world, but I think this will be a very important piece of the long-term strategy that Oregon Inc. is trying to pursue.
If I may, Mr. Chair, what we're trying to leverage here is we've already made a huge investment in university research. We've already made we're already down the road. What we're trying to do is get from that stage to sort of the commercial value of some of these investments. And that's what Oregon Inc. is about, trying to strategically look at these things and not in some scattershot way, but where can we put the cloud that's going to bring this rain of future jobs and economic growth. And this is a perfect vehicle to help us with that because that's its real purpose. So a little change here just sort of lines things up a little better so we can get on with it.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Treasurer, could you comment generally on how long you might take a position? And it strikes me that this is something of a bridge mechanism to get the research kind of to the commercial stage. And do you generally then take a position just long to get it to that stage and then leave that position in order to help the next great idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, that's exactly the way in which we operate. And we're trying to find, look at investing, I got to be, again, straight up with it. You take risk, right? Some of these ideas may never fly. And particularly when you're getting up the idea of early stage, or if you've got a professor with something that looks pretty interesting in the lab, it takes a fair amount of hand-holding to realize that there may be some commercial value to that. And some of it may never pan out. That happens. But our idea here is to say, with the Oregon Growth Account, we have that opportunity to do that, look upstream a lot farther than we've been able to. And that, I think, should be very helpful. But again, that's the hope, is as you just described it.
Thank you. We're removing from this bill all the language that refers to the traded sector. To what extent is that current language limiting to the fund's operations?
I guess a better way to
say it is, why do you want that language removed?
Well, I think I said that, which is that traded sectors tends to focus on matured marketplaces, and so some of these ideas are much removed from that. They're not in the traded sector by definition. Maybe Paul can explain that better than I can. It just gives us the ability to put money in areas that aren't handicapped by traded sector.
But could we say that you don't know yet whether they're going to involve traded sector outcomes or not? Would that be
an
accurate way of saying it?
Correct.
Potentially traded sector.
Right.
So this simply means that you're free to invest in any areas that look to you as though they show some promise.
Correct.
Do these have to be Oregon businesses, or can they be anywhere?
That's the intent, Oregon.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like we're stepping off into some realm of unknowns, but that is the Oregon Inc. vision, which is that these are not unknown. They are strategically picked by Oregon Inc. to have the greatest chance of creating successful, probably traded sector jobs in Oregon. So we're not asking for let's go tell the treasurer to go off and see what he can find. Oregon Inc. has strategically identified where we think our research and our strategic place in both the global economy and the world and resources, that we think these ideas should bear the most fruit for Oregon. So we're not
right
by this saying to the treasurer, oh, just go find something. Oregon Inc. has a strategic plan for where we think those best ideas are. They are not without risk, but it's a portfolio approach where we've come up with a number of things, and they all look good. You just don't know how good any one is going to be.
Yeah. Well, I think all of us who do any investing know that in a well-diversified portfolio, there's some some real fuddy-duddy things that are going to produce a little bit every year, and you know they're always going to forever. And on the other end, there's some
right.
flyers that you hope will make you some money, and right. you haven't got too much invested in them in case they don't. The question I have that leads out of that comment is, how's it going? How's the fund doing?
Actually, Mr. Chair, this fund was started in 1999, and in fact, my predecessor put out the first monies. We've had some do quite well, and some are struggling, and part of that was when the money was invested in 1999, we all remember that the bubble burst in 2000, and so some of these partnerships that we put, and by the way, we were talking about, we gave money to partners who then went out and found these investments. But since that time, we've been re-upping, putting more money out into different partnerships, and it's too early to tell, but I feel confident that we're doing the right job and trying to find, again, people who are willing to take the risk with us.
Yeah, Representative Reed.
One last one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the state's participation in various places attracted more private investment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, yes. I think one of the goals has always been to try to do two things. One, help seed ideas and opportunities in the state, and two, to try to develop an infrastructure, financial infrastructure, to try to help bring private capital here, other people's capital beyond lottery money. And I think we've been able to do that. I'll give you an example. Smart Forest was not in Oregon until we gave it the first money, and they've been able to leverage federal dollars and other private money to invest in Oregon. That didn't happen, or wouldn't have happened, but for the beginning of OGA and that partnership that we gave them. So that, to me, has always been part of the goal here, too, is to nurture the infrastructure to help the long term.
Thank you.
Right.
Any time when we can help Oregon businesses and at the same time have a reasonable hope of maintaining the security of the Education Stability Fund is a win-win.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for
I have one other witness signed up, and that's for the Software Association. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. For the record, Jack Esselman, Tonkin Tour, preparing today on behalf of the Software Association of Oregon. We are Oregon's largest locally headquartered technology trade association with over 600 members across the state of Oregon. And as I start, briefly, just let me communicate on behalf of our members, many of whom, or several of whom, are executives of companies and are serving on the Oregon Innovation Council with your colleagues. We greatly appreciate the amount of volunteer time. Representative Berger, the Treasurer, Representative Butler, Senator Deckert, Senator Morse, and others from this assembly and the government have put into putting together this innovation plan. Truly been a remarkable effort in terms of the time committed and I think the output that resulted. And on behalf of our association, we are very happy with the outcomes. I'll just echo the treasurer and the representative's support of the bill. We believe this gets at an important need in Oregon, which is access to capital. Venture capital investments across the country, according to a recent survey by Venture One and Ernst & Young, grew in 2005 by 8.2%. A total of $25 billion was invested in 2005 across the country. However, in Oregon, during the same time frame, our venture investment dropped by nearly 39% year over year. And per capita, Oregon draws venture capital at one-third the national average. Now, there's many reasons for this, and they're not all addressed by this bill. But we think this bill is an important step. It's a modest change to the law that we think can have some important impacts across the venture capital continuum in the state. So for that reason, we urge your yes, we see high da vote, however you'd like to put it on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Esselman. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony today. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 579? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 579. Representative Berger, is this bill ready to work?
It is by me.
All right, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 579. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 579 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 579 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? This doesn't have a subsequent, does it?
I don't believe so.
No, it doesn't. There's no subsequent. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Berger?
Yes.
Representative Braun?
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative
Olson. Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative
Durham. Aye.
Representative
Witt. Excused.
Chair Barnard.
Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is also excused. The motion carries, and the bill will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Berger, I assume you'd like to carry this.
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to carry this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Berger will carry the bill, and I would simply note before we close the work session that when we actually get down to talking about money, even the members of the committee get very conservative, and I appreciate that. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 579.
Mr. Chair, In light of the fact that you've given me two bills to carry, and I don't know the procedure of this, but Representative Reed is very interested in Senate Bill 66, and I don't need more to carry. So how about if we let Mr. Representative Reed carry 66, and I'll keep 579.
Any objection?
Isn't that the revenue rule number 14 or something like that?
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
A veteran's able to hand off the baton to the rookie?
So I take it you don't object. Okay. All right.
We're only on a Thursday.
Can we change the record to show that Representative Reed will carry Senate Bill 66?
I believe I was a proponent of putting that on the consent calendar. Representative Berger here requested that on the consent calendar. So it seems very consistent.
We do have an objection to that.
Mr. Chair, there's some things rookies don't know how to do and veterans do.
Representative Reed will carry the bill. All right. And they will learn fast. Thank you. Okay, we have another bill in that segment, and that's Senate Bill 64. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 64. And that's your bill again.
Yes, sir.
We're making you play musical chairs today. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the Senate Bill 64 also comes to you from your counterpart on the Senate side. This came from the Finance and Revenue, or started there. Senate Bill 64 also deals with the investment of the State Treasurer and the Oregon Growth Account Board as part of the Investment Council. However, the scope of the bill is more technical in the sense of exempting these certain investments from our public disclosure laws, records for public disclosure. The genesis of the bill, as in the ORS 192.502, there are certain levels of exemptions from this public disclosure, including things of the nature of social security numbers and employee names and so on. This would allow for certain records of companies and investments within those firms to be exempt from that disclosure for the purpose of competitiveness and allowing for trade secrets and so on. That is in a nutshell what the bill in front of you attempts to do, and I'm sure you would
we'll have a lot more of the discussion with us.
Thank you. I have five people signed up. It looks as though they all were signed up by the same hand. And I'm going to call them, and you come up in the order that you think you should be heard in. Let's see, Mark Dorman, Jerry Langelier, I think, D. Carlson, Ron Schmitz, Kate Richardson.
All right. Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you. For the record, I'm Jerry Langler from Portland. I'm here representing OVP Venture Partners today. We're a venture capital firm. We've been in business for 24 years, and for all of those 24 years have managed Oregon Public Employees Retirement System's money, along with a lot of other pension funds and endowments and other institutional bodies. And we think this is a very good bill on two fronts. One, we think it's good policy, and the second, we think it's consistent policy. Consistent isn't always good on its face, but let me explain what I mean by that. But before I get to that, quickly, a venture capital firm does partly what you were just hearing. We invest in young companies, in our case, you know, most of them, the vast majority of them, with no sales. Products are still under development. Pushing the state-of-the-art of technology, and one hopes becoming large companies someday, and we help them grow. Now, for them to compete, they have to not only develop a better mousetrap, but then they've got to go sell that better mousetrap, usually against large, multinational, entrenched competitors. And so that's a daunting challenge that, fortunately, we have entrepreneurs willing to take. But in so doing, they come with the advantage, perhaps, of their advanced technology and the disadvantage of a lot of fragility inside their company, including just, frankly, the economics of their company, their balance sheet. They don't have the big cash hoard that a multinational would have. And here I'll tell you a story. We recently sold one of our companies to a large multinational. And in the process of doing that, we made a nice profit for the retirees that we frankly didn't deserve. This company was not in very good shape. It had some nice technology, but we were getting very concerned about it. And we would have sold that company for considerably less than our investment had we been pushed. The reason we were able to sell it for more is because the buyer didn't know how frustrated we were. But I can assure you that the state treasurer's office did, because as part of our disclosure from us to them, we issue a quarterly report every quarter with a great deal of detail about how each one of these portfolio companies is doing. And had the buyer had access to that information, they would have said, OVP and the other investors in this company are tired and frustrated. We can drive them down. So that's one sort of where we made money we didn't deserve. The flip side, you know, is there are many times when our companies are doing well, and we also don't want that disclosure to happen because how well they're doing can be used for competitive advantage, particularly on their technology side, which we also tend to reveal to the public employees retirement system staff. And the reason we do that for them is they have to make a decision on our successive funds, which come up about every 4 years, in the absence of a lot of concrete data. The average company we invest in takes at least 7 years to get to a liquidity event. And so you can't tell yet how good that fund is for it probably 5 to 7 years from the time we started. So along the way, we may be raising a new fund when the old fund is still cooking. And the only way the PERS staff can decide whether they want to invest in our next fund, at least based on past results, is to have really good insight into how that portfolio is doing, which we make available to them, but we would not make available to the public. So why is this good policy? Number one, it does maintain the open accountability for us. Our numbers are public, have been for many years through PERS, and that's fine. That the decision PERS makes is to invest in us, and the public gets to find out how well we're doing. And we think that's very fair and appropriate. It continues to allow that open communication between us and PERS staff and their consultants so they know how we're doing. It keeps private data private. I mean, these companies we're investing in are private companies. And if one was to breach that boundary, they are no longer private companies. They are now public companies, maybe not regulated by the SEC, but they have become essentially public companies with all the trouble that that entails for a small young company. This also, I think, and I'll speak more broadly in the industry, it allows the Oregon PERS and the Oregon Growth Account to access more funds that they might want to be in. In the private equity business, the pendulum swings between buyer's market and seller's market, but there are clearly some funds that are very high-performing funds that would not accept any institution that would breach the boundary to reveal the private data of their portfolio companies. And we, frankly, are one of those. I mean, we have in the past talked to potential institutional investors in the state of Colorado and the state of Texas, and there was a period of time where both of them actually had not made this defining line clear, and we had nice conversations, but we would not have accepted their money at that time had they offered it. So it gives PERS the opportunity to be on parity with its other compatriots in assessing those good funds. And then I'll go to the consistency issue, which I think is very important. One, it's consistent with past practice. This is the way PERS has managed itself for as long as we've been involved in them. So we and other current investees have come to rely on it. But also I think it is consistent with the Sunshine Statute and process in Oregon public policy, which is, this is a Sunshine State. I fully support that. I served on a school board as chair, so I've been subject to it. But even within those laws, there are exceptions where being open would be counterproductive. In my small case in the school board, if you had an employment issue or labor negotiations, those are not subject to those laws because it would be counterproductive to do so. I think this is exactly one of those cases where we should be subject to the Sunshine Statutes and are, but going through us to the next level would be counterproductive. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. Mr. Chairman and colleagues, my name is Mark Dorman, and I'm a partner with Endeavor Capital. Endeavor Capital is a private equity firm based in Portland. We're managing now our fourth fund, which Oregon PERS is an investor. Oregon PERS was also an investor in our third fund. Whereas Jerry's firm focuses on venture capital and more early stage companies, we're investing in more traditional, we call traditional companies, but companies that are profitable, larger in size, typically not involved in technology where their business doesn't depend on technology. And I'm also here to support the bill because I think it's not only important for firms like ours, Endeavor Capital, but I think it's also important for the state. It's good for us, and it's good for private equity firms that take money from the state, because maintaining confidential data, as Jerry mentioned, is paramount. As you can imagine, if you were owners of a business, you don't want your competitors, your customers, to be able to access your margins, your sales, and data like that. I think if prospective companies that we were looking to invest in knew that data would be disclosed, I think it would severely limit our competitiveness and really put us at a disadvantage in the marketplace. I think it's good for Oregon because I'm sure most of you know Oregon really is viewed as one of the top two or three public pension fund investors in the country. And you ask, well, why is that important? Well, it's important because it gives Oregon the access to the best performing funds, and the staff is known as very knowledgeable and value added, trustworthy, and I know today that they're not able to invest in some of the leading firms because of the issues that this bill addresses. So I would encourage support of this bill, and I think it's a win-win for everybody.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I have one, and it may be that others should answer it. I don't know. And that's the question is, how was the language in the bill derived? I mean, was it proposed by...
I will give at least one bit of answer simply because I did this testimony before your counterparts
a month ago,
but I think there are people who can answer. But I think the language was largely lifted from other states who have gone before you.
So this has been, if I could just continue with that, then this has been vetted in some other states. It works there for the investment funds. And after all, this issue is a balance, isn't it?
Yes.
Between our desire to get into some of these good investment funds, and on the other hand, the need for public disclosure in areas where secrecy isn't absolutely required.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yes. And so, but again, I think you're wise to ask that question of some of the other folks, particularly, I know Ron Schmitz, I think, can answer that. But I believe the answer is it has, the others have gone before you.
Sure. And they're here and they can include that in their remarks too, yeah, as well. Thank you. Other questions that generates? Thank you very much. I appreciate a very cogent explanation of this bill. That's very helpful. And then there were three others who I listed. I won't repeat their names. Please come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kate Richardson. I'm Chief of Staff for State Treasurer Randall Edwards. And we're here to, this is a bill that the Treasurer decided to bring forward this session because we have, although this has always been a theoretical problem, we have started to bump into this in the real world where we are missing some opportunities because Oregon's law is not clear on this point. I do want to emphasize right out that this is codifying existing practice and actually is making express the current state of the law. These protections are already in our law but not very express, and particularly through the trade secrets exemption, and I'll let Dee Carlson from the Department of Justice to address that specifically. But we want to make clear that the reason we're bringing this forward, and specifically with the long language we have here, is because our partners that we'd like to work with, our private equity partners, real estate partners, are looking for specific language that gives them the reassurance that they need. In answer to your question earlier, Representative Barnhart, about the language, it was taken from California's law. And that was this issue actually kind of came out in a couple different places in the nation, but in California this was language that's actually worked out with various stakeholders, including the media unions and the investment funds, and this has been placed into California statute and has become the industry standard across the nation. 15 other states roughly have language that does make express. And it is long, but I will say that most of that language is addressing what is public, making sure that it's clear that top line, if you will, information about the fund in which the OIC is investing remains public and is provided. I handle all the public records requests for the Office of the State Treasurer, and this won't change our practice. This is exactly what we've been sharing and providing. I do get public records requests about this type of material, and we've never had a problem with what we've provided and what we've not provided in the past, never been challenged. Most of our public records requests for this kind of material does come from competitors or from folks trying to market this information. So it's not just necessarily your general public requesting this information. And we do have Ron Schmitz here, who's our Chief Investment Officer at the State Treasurer's Office, and Dee Carlson, who advises the Oregon Investment Council from the Department of Justice. So I will let them address this most from their areas of expertise.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ron Schmitz, Director of the Investment Division in the Office of the State Treasurer. Together with my staff, we're responsible for the management of OPERF and other asset pools that total over $75 billion. I think our original plan was for the three of us to go first and turn it over to the more detailed gentlemen, but since they came up first, part of what I was going to say is would be a bit repetitive, so let me self-edit in the interest of time. Basically, in a nutshell, increasingly the general partners with whom OPERF invests or with whom my staff invests through the OIC are excluding public fund investors from the funds they manage unless there are very explicit protections about the disclosure of information.
Historically, you know, as Kate alluded, we've had success in dealing with this, you know, without specific exemptions. But from a perception versus reality standpoint, it is now increasingly a problem where general partners just point blank exclude funds, public funds that are subject to disclosures from investing. Some of the examples of firms that have excluded public investors in the past are Kleiner Perkins, Moore David Dow, Sequoia, Menlo Ventures. There are dozens of others, so I just throw those out, to name a few. And for reasons espoused earlier by the previous panel. Why is this critical? And I think this is something that hasn't been touched on yet, but in the private equity world, the spread between top managers and lower performing managers is surprisingly large, sometimes 10% a year or less, or more, rather. So it's critical that OPERF have access to the top performing funds and maintain that access that we currently enjoy. As Kate mentioned, 15 other states have passed laws similar to this, including California, who's the model for our bill today. So we in the Treasurer's Office from the Investment Division strongly urge the passage of Senate Bill 64. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dee Carlson. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm one of the counsel from the department to the Treasurer's Office, and specifically with respect to the Investment Division. And as has been expressed here earlier, this is really a modernization of a exemption that presently exists in Oregon law at ORS 192.502.13. When that law was, that exemption was codified, the development of the private equity market was still very early, and as a consequence, the market has moved beyond where our old law language was. As we have dealt with public records requests in this area, we have relied upon three or four specific exemptions in the law. In addition to subsection 13 of 502, we've relied on 192.502.9, which includes other statutes as an exemption that would fold in the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which is in ORS Chapter 646. We've relied specifically on 192.501.2, which is a conditional trade secrets exemption. Oregon law is very interesting that it has two independent trade secrets exemptions. They don't match up in language or consequences. The Uniform Trade Secrets Act, as an example, is more general, more comprehensive, and also includes some penalties, monetary penalties for violating it. Whereas the Public Records Exemption 192.501.2 does not have that. It's not conditional, as is in 192.501.2. There's also a confidential submissions exemption under 192.502.4. So when a request comes in, one or more of these exemptions come into play. And as Kate has expressed, we are at about the same equivalent place in terms of what we release and what we don't release. Unfortunately for the marketplace, we are not able to provide the bright lines and the clarity that the decisions we make won't be challenged and potentially subsequently reversed depending upon an interpretation of law, since many of these provisions have not been tested fully in court. And those leading firms that Ron was speaking to simply don't want to take any risk. What they want are clarity. They want an ability to plan going forward in the future. And they want things, and since it is right now a seller's market, they're able to command that. They want the kind of bright line knowledge that the California legislation or model provides, and that's why we've used that language. As Kate mentioned, it's been heavily vetted with the media, with labor and others when it was being enacted, and it emphasizes, most of the language is emphasizing what remains public, and in many respects more becomes public, are available to the public than might be when one looked through all the Oregon exemptions as we cobble them together right now. So it provides a nice balance, I think, a nice accountability to the public about what is going on with their monies, and at the same time allows the state to invest in the private equity world, which of course has been the leading returner of earnings for this fund for a number of years, and one which has distinguished and helped it in its superior performance.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I have a couple. You've mentioned CalPERS and also the Oregon Public Employee Retirement system. This, of course, doesn't apply just to them. It applies to pretty much all of our investment funds, does it not? Where that may be of interest?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does to the investment funds of the Oregon Investment Council, and I'll let Ron speak to how that plays out, though, in effect. I also want to emphasize that it also reaches the Oregon Growth Account, which is in a different statute, and that's Chapter 348, and it's for the same reasons, and it's investing in the same type of investments. For in practical terms, although it does reach all the investment funds that the Oregon Investment Council has, I'll let Ron explain that, in effect, it's primarily the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund.
By 98% or 99% of the assets involved that we're talking about here would be LPERF assets. But we are have recently started a move into private equity investments in the Common School Fund as well. So that would be affected also.
Thank you. And as I review the language in this measure, it appears as though what you're really saying here is that the details of the investments, which are secrets of the investment firms, will not be revealed. But our participation and the amount of our participation and the value of our participation will be. Is that a fair summary, do you think, of I think I'm referring to subsection 14 of 502.
Sure, Chair Barnhart. We currently disclose and have for a long time. In fact, Oregon was a leader, I think, in disclosing this before a lot of other states even did. We disclose the amount of money invested in a given fund, the fund strategy, and how that fund has returned. But that's the fund in the aggregate, what we call top-line information. We do not disclose, for reasons Dee has talked about, we have not disclosed historically the detailed portfolio company, specific company by company information that general partner makes. But we do disclose how the fund has performed and what funds were invested in and the dollar amounts.
Thank you. And Dee, are you ready to defend this bill? Is this bill ready?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think this is a good bill.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 64? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 64. What's your pleasure, committee? Do you want some time to study this, or are you ready? You're ready. You're ready. All right. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 64.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 64 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bruhn moves Senate Bill 64 to the
Senator.
You get
Representative Bruhn. Sorry. You know, when we use the term senator and representative, I sometimes get confused, and I apologize. I would not want to demote you that way. Representative Bruhn.
We know which sides of the fund.
Move Senate Bill 64 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative River.
Aye.
Representative Broome.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
And Chair Barnard.
Aye. And Representative Butler is excused. Who would like to carry this bill? Representative Broome.
I volunteer.
Thank you. Representative Broome will carry, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 64.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I request that we suspend the rules and open Senate Bill 579 to allow Representative Witt to vote?
Representative Broome moves for the suspension of the rules Representative Witt to vote on Senate Bill 579. Representative Witt to vote on Senate Bill 579. Is that the one?
Yes.
Is there any objection? If not, it is so ordered. Representative Witt, how do you vote?
Votes aye.
Representative Witt votes aye on Senate Bill 579. And it's not quite 2:30. And I have managed to lose my agenda. The problem is my notes are in it.
Oh.
Yeah. There it is. I'm at 2:30. We're going to hear from Representative Jensen. I think we have time to open a public hearing on House Bill 2752. Chris is on that one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2752, as drafted, is identical to House Bill 3177, which you heard last week, and it modifies the Working Family Child Care Credit. Under current law, to be eligible for the credit, the taxpayer must be gainfully employed or seeking employment or attending school. This bill would allow a taxpayer to claim the credit in the case of a disability that prevents the taxpayer from providing child care or being employed or attending school. That's as drafted. You also have a -1 amendment that we just received today that provides some additional language pertaining to some definitions. And what the -1s do is it defines a disability as a physical or cognitive condition that results in a person requiring assistance with activities of daily living. The -1s also require the Department of Human Services to establish by rule procedures for assessing whether a taxpayer has a disability, as that term is used in this section. And it allows a qualified taxpayer who is married to claim the credit under the section based on a disability regardless of the employment status of the taxpayer's spouse.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Chris, this... So with these changes, though, the income limits would still be applicable?
Representative Rosenbaum, yes, and I'm not sure exactly how that last piece fits together, because one of the requirements to claim the credit is that a certain amount of earned income be earned.
Right.
And if you have one spouse who has the disability, then they would be exempt, so to speak. But then if the other taxpayer, if the other spouse is not required to be employed, I'm not sure where the earned income would come from, so I'm not sure. I haven't had a chance to talk to Ledge Council to see how those two pieces would fit together.
Okay. We don't have anyone signed up on this bill. Is there anyone who would like to... Representative Gelser?
I had a question.
Please.
On staff. Do you have an idea of what the revenue impact of this bill would be?
Representative Gelser, I haven't looked at it specifically. I don't think it would be very large. I'm not sure how many taxpayers would fit into those specific categories.
Thank you. Now, is there anyone who would like to be heard on this bill today? I don't see anyone, and for that, therefore, we'll close the public hearing. We'll reopen the public hearing. Representative Holvey is here. Please. You've made it under the wire, Representative Holvey.
Sorry.
Your office is on the far end of the world, and it does take a while to get down here. Please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I assume we're talking about House Bill 2752.
We are.
And I appreciate you having a hearing on this. This came over from the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness, I believe.
That's correct.
I'm going to give my testimony over here. So, but it was appropriate that this came over here for consideration, and I hope the committee does take a look at it. House Bill 2752 allows taxpayers with disabilities that prevent them from providing child care or being employed or attending school to receive the Working Family Child Care Income Tax Credit for child care expenses. This bill's pretty simple, really. It came to me from a constituent issue, and I believe Representative Clem also had a similar constituent issue, and you'll see he's also on the bill. It's just basically a problem that many families where one of the parent is disabled and the other parent is working, and they have to have child care services, you know, to provide child care for their kids, and the parent is disabled, is unable to provide that care. And currently, under the law, since that parent is at home, that disqualifies them for the working family income tax credit. One of the issues that came up, as Representative Gelser will know, was in looking at this in the other committee, that we were concerned about the breadth of this bill and its implications if everybody that was classified as disabled would claim this credit. It would be pretty large. So we were looking at how to really narrow this down so that it was available to those that really needed it. And so that represents the draft one amendment. I hope that the committee has that in front of them. Where we did try to just for the purposes of this bill, narrow down the definition of disability so that it meant a physical or cognitive condition that resulted in a person requiring assistance with activities of daily living, to really narrow that down somewhat, and also added in that the Department of Human Services should establish by rule and procedures for assessing whether a taxpayer has a disability as it's defined there. So really kind of a two-part look at individuals with disabilities to make sure that, you know, the people that are disabled that really do need this working family income tax credit can get it. Because frankly, when they've just got one wage earner in the family, and somebody at home who's disabled who can't really provide that kind of care for their children, you know, they're really at an economic disadvantage, and I really feel that hopefully if in the tax credit world of the House Committee on Revenue, if there's room for expanding this tax credit, that this committee would consider that, because I think it would be a big help to those families. Pretty much it, simple bill. It's just a matter of whether your committee has the extra money or revenue in the tax credit world.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And, Paul, I don't know if you were in the room yet when we were just discussing the fact that the current tax credit has a requirement that you have a minimum income threshold. I think it started out as $6,000, and it looks like from the staff summary it's now
$7,100.
So it's not clear how your change and that fit together. Do you know, was it the intention to still have that be applicable, or how would that work?
Yeah, this wasn't meant to change that any provisions of the requirements for the working family income tax credit. It just wanted to make sure that these individuals could apply for it and could get it.
Okay, and then they obviously still have to be paying this money out in terms of paying for child care too.
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Also, I think before you arrived, we were talking about the import of the amendment in line on the dash ones, line 11 through 13, I think it was. Is that right, Chris?
Yes, that was.
And we're trying to make certain that we understand that the law requires now that there be earned income of something over $7,000 a year before a person would qualify. And it appears as though this may exclude the employment status of the taxpayer's spouse. Was this intended to exclude the taxpayer's spouse's income from the qualification, or do you know?
I don't believe it was, but you know, I just got these amendments probably about the same time you did, so I didn't have any discussion about that. So I don't believe we were trying to exclude any income and whether this makes somebody qualify or not.
So your theory is that if you have a child in the home who has daycare costs that would normally apply under this rule, providing they care. And you have a disabled parent who needs assistance with the activities of daily living, therefore needs assistance him or herself for care. The fact that that parent is in the home won't disqualify the family from receiving this credit. That's your intent, as I understand.
That's exactly correct.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Holvey?
Well, I'm not sure this is a question for Representative Holvey, but I guess I'm still struggling with exactly how this all fits together, because there are income cutoffs too. So you get this credit, but it phases out at various levels of income, and you're not trying to exclude the income from the other spouse from those, because this is a family credit, so it's based on the family's income.
That is correct.
And you're not trying to change any of those things.
No.
Yes, Chris.
In thinking about this, I think it's the case, if I'm understanding it correctly, where you have two spouses where one of them is working and meeting the income requirements, and the other spouse has a disability that prevents them from providing child care. Because under current law, that is, those people would not be allowed to get the credit. Now, if just the disability piece were met, then they would be allowed to get the working family credit. So it looks like the intent is that targeted family where one spouse is working and then the other is disabled to the point where they can't provide the child care.
And that's, Mr. Chair, that's because currently if you had somebody at home, presumably they'd be providing child care.
Correct. In the law, it allows, the only case in which that would be allowed is if the parent providing the child care is doing so in a as part of a child care business.
Right. Okay.
Representative Gelser.
Mr. Chair, I wondered if I could ask this in another way.
Please.
If it says afterwards that the qualified taxpayer is eligible based on disability regardless of the employment status of the taxpayer spouse, does the taxpayer spouse need to be working in order for the family to be eligible for the? So does somebody in the household have to be working? So we're pulling these people in so they're not excluded just because they're home but not able to care for the kids, but there's still someone in the household that's working.
Good question. They have to have earned income.
They have to have earned income.
And if we understand exactly what earned income means, then we know the answer to that question.
Earned income will be from wages or from owning a business, and it excludes under-earned income, which would be interest, dividends, capital gains. Another limitation on this is that the unearned income is capped at a certain amount. They're allowed to have some unearned income, but only it's about $3,000 now, I think.
Okay,
so the whole point is that they are either employed by somebody or they own a business and are earning the income.
And so you have to have at least
$7,100 in 2006, I believe.
$7,100 of earned income and a maximum of some other number.
About, I believe it's $3,000 of unearned income.
Of unearned income. And then I assume that it phases out after a while, too, when your earned income gets too high as well.
Yes,
it
goes up to 250% of the federal poverty level.
Okay.
So it depends on the family size, the exact dollar amount.
And that's all in the Section 1 on the first page of the bill.
That's all current law.
Current law, right.
That's all current law.
Well, it seems to me as though we'd better do two things. We'd better check to make sure the amendment does what Representative Holvey wants it to do. And then we'd better figure out what our revenue impact is. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 2752?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I can be of any more help, you know my phone number.
Yeah, we do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
I just wanted to thank Representative Holvey because we talked previously about how to define the population, and this was really good.
It's a clever way of doing it.
Thank you.
It is. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2752. And we have another representative who's impatiently waiting for three different meetings of this committee to be heard on House Bill 3187 and House Joint Resolution 40. And we'll open a public hearing on those. Representative Jensen. We'll hear from Paul first and then from the good representative.
Mr. Chair, what HJR 40 does is it requires the legislature to enact a general sales and use tax if the fiscal impact of voter-approved initiatives that were approved after January 1 of 97 exceed a certain percentage. That percentage is blank of general fund expenditures. So this allows the legislature to suspend imposition of the sales tax if an unspecified majority, a supermajority of both chambers agree. And also a majority of voters required if there's an agreement that the fiscal situation does not warrant the sales tax. It must be enacted, HGR 40 must be enacted prior to 1109 for the 3187 to go into place. Representative Jensen did ask me to work a little bit on some of the numbers, and just to give you a sense, we have looked at the voter passed initiative since 1197. That would not include Measure 5, of course, which is still the big one that dominates the general fund budget, but it would include Measure 50, which was enacted in May, and also Measure 11. And the impact we've estimated for 07 and 09 be up a little short of $1.9 billion, about $1.86 billion. And that's about 13.5% of the general fund budget presented by the co-chairs last month. So that gives you an idea of some of the numbers. One other thing I would add for the committee, because you had some testimony on 3187 yesterday, 3187 is drafted largely as kind of a template, really based on the tangible personal property sales tax of 93. It has a lot of that language needs to be updated. The one main thing that is updated, and there's been a fair amount of work on this in recent sessions, Senator Gordley had a bill last session require if any sales tax is enacted, that it would be under the streamlined sales tax agreement. And last session the committee had some discussion about what the states are doing and that and why. So that's also included in 3187.
The streamlined agreement.
Yes.
Is included. Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
And Representative Jensen, there's a peculiarity of the microphones in this room. If you let it back a ways, it works better. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How's it?
That's much
better.
We doing
better? My name is Bob Jensen. I'm state representative from House District 58. And I am here to present to you what I think would be a pragmatic and practical solution to a very chronic problem that we have in the state of Oregon. That chronic problem is the citizen-initiated legislation by initiative process. Now, before there's a misunderstanding on that, please let me clarify for the record that I support the citizens' rights to do this. I am not about to be here to propose a constitutional amendment to do away with that or anything of that nature, but due to the complexity of or the interpretation of our court, only one item may appear on the citizen-initiated topics, and as a consequence, some of those topics that have what I would call unfunded mandates are left up to we, the legislature, to find ways to fund them. And unfortunately, as you've heard from Paul in the relationship to what some of these costs have been on it, two particular items, that is ballot measure 50, ballot measure 11, it's only 13.5% of our general budget. What 13.5% isn't very much money until you multiply it by 14.929 billion. And, we got to real money very quickly with that. I have a few things that I'm handing out to you here, and I know since I've been in this building that no legislator gets as much to read as they would like to be able to read. So I want to contribute to that. And I must apologize on the back page of this on the second page of this, there's an article that I have no objection to your reading, but it has nothing to do with what I had intended to be. I think it would be worthwhile for people to read. You know, it's an editorial out of the Oregonian, but my staff, for some reason or another, now to understand, my particular staff never make a mistake. So obviously it's a mistake that the representative must have made, but it wasn't intended. But I do think a state of low-wage jobs in I believe it was the Monday Oregonian, I find to be a very informative for the topic that we're talking about here. Additionally, I've given you a couple of amateur-produced, you know, not from legislative revenue, not from legislative fiscal, but from the representative's office, and not even from his able staff, but from his own, you know, feeble undertakings. A couple of graphs, I think, that are extremely informative. And I would submit for you the pie charts that you have there, and if you look at them and look please carefully at what has happened to education funding in the state of Oregon, and this is total education funding, it's human services and public safety for and then other for reference there to the guide to the pie charts. And if you look at 1997, and I picked 97 for a reason, because that was the year that I first came to the legislature, and it also was a year that Ballot Measure 5 was pretty much fully implemented. So we can be talking about apples and apples, not having to go through, though Mr. Warner would be more than able to walk you through the differences of when we had more property tax supporting education. But just to stay on the apples and apples issue, we had 59.5 roughly percent of our general fund lottery monies went to all education. K-12 through university education. If we look today, we have 53.71%. Okay, you know, it's not even 6%. Only 5+% times $14.929 billion. That's a lot of money. And the education, and one of the other things you can see off of the line graph, you can see that also that education is the one particular item that has declined. I don't care what anybody says, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. If you look at the data, clearly, education has paid for all of the other things that we have, some of which have come from citizen-initiated legislation. I don't think the citizens intend, you know, for this their legislation to drive us into bankruptcy. I think I think they're very sincere and very earnest in what they do, and I think some of them at least would be willing to put the other component in their legislation, that is how to fund it, if they were going to be constitutionally able to do that. What I am proposing for you in the bill is legislation that where this ballot measure 11 appears, and where it exceeds the given percentage that we have of 1997, that percentage of the budget, then that would be made up for by a sales tax. Not that all of it would be paid for by the sales tax, only the excess over what we had at a base year. Where you choose to put that base year, how you choose to do that as a committee, I'd be happy to work with you. I'd be happy to bow to you know, very professional expertise that we have, but some way to be able to deal with this issue, because it will reappear, we know that, and every time it happens, if it process continues, it's education that's going to pay the bill. And I did, and I know, Mr. Chairman, for you that who are sit on the Joint Ways and Means Education Sub, this is, you know, kind of second, third, fourth, fifth time material. But I did some just quick research over the weekend on going on the internet and looking at the cost of higher education and our universities versus other comparable sort of universities, or maybe some that aren't quite so comparable. But I compared the University of Oregon to the University of Iowa. Now, that may be a compliment to Oregon, or it may be a compliment to Iowa, but it seemed to me they're reasonably sort of the same types of conferences, kind of so-so as far as their athletic programs are concerned. you know, most things considered, they'd be on a kind of fair comparison. At the University of Idaho, with tuition and fees, for an annual base, $6,293.
Excuse me, is that Iowa?
Iowa. University of Iowa. $6,293. University of Oregon, $6,762. That's about a $500 bill any way you slice it up.
We're talking about tuition and fees now.
Tuition and fees.
Thank you.
If we compare it to Washington State University, which I didn't take Oregon State, but it's very comparable to U of O. If you looked at Washington State, it's $5,888. If you looked at the University of Washington, which is in some circles considered to be a fairly prestigious university that attracts in some circles, I'm told, nothing but the best and the brightest, the University of Washington fees and tuition would be $6,285 against our $6,762. So incomparable universities in a lot of different ways, and sometimes they're maybe a little more, we're paying, our students, our kids are paying more money. Why are they paying more money? Because we ain't got the money to pay to the university to make up for it. I've got a whole page full of examples, and I'd choose not to bore you with those, but I'd be happy to sometime over some other setting than this. Only thank you today for your indulgence for listening to me on this. Mr. Chair, my wildest dreams would be for this committee to pass this out, and for the House to pass it out, and for it to go to the Senate, and go then to the citizens of the state. I've been in this state a long time. I've suffered through a number of sales tax votes. I know what the people think about them. I understand all of those issues. But I do submit, Mr. Chair, that it is time that this issue be addressed. There's no way out of it. We have to address this issue, or this is going to get worse rather than better, because we can't short our educational system and continue the lifestyle that we all, the quality of life that we all would like Oregon to be known for. Thank you kindly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know you're pressing your time, and I think maybe there's one or two other people who might want to say something good, bad, or indifferent. I'm not sure about that.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Are there questions for Representative Jensen? I would simply comment that you're giving my campaign speech, not on the bill itself, but on the concept and the issues that we're facing in Oregon.
Mr. Chair,
my constituents would agree with you. The ones who voted for me would agree with you completely.
Mr. Chairman, this has been my campaign speech for some number of years. And my constituents are probably less likely than most of your constituents to look on sales tax with favor, or any tax with favor. And somehow or another, I've gotten away with giving this campaign speech and still coming back.
Thank you, sir. Representative Gelson.
Sure. I just wanted to thank you for the presentation. We've heard a lot about comprehensive tax reform, which I think is very important, but this piece of that component, being able to reform our system so that we match up when voters are purchasing new programs, putting some accountability there, I think is an important piece of that whole idea of comprehensive, helpful tax reform. No matter how we reform the system, if at the ballot box we keep expanding the programs unchecked, reform isn't going to solve the problem completely.
Thank you, Representative. And I would, as you I'm sure know, that I was on one of those
yep.
bills, and I've been on that particular issue now for six sessions. As a freshman Democrat in 1997, one of my agendas, along with several of the other people who are on those bills, was tax reform in the state of Oregon. It is five sessions later. It's still the agenda, and it will remain so as long as I'm in the building, and maybe even after I leave the building.
Unless we do it.
Unless you do.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3187 or House Joint Resolution 40? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearings on those bills. Colleagues, it's 5 minutes to three. We have several more bills to do. My inclination is to hold them over till tomorrow. I'm getting head nods, and I apologize to anyone who may be here to be heard on House Bill 3364 or Senate Bill 171 or Senate Bill 697, because those are going to be held over till tomorrow. And we also had a work session on House Bill 3468. Which will also be held over to tomorrow. Have I missed any? All right. Thank you. And with that, we're adjourned.
It is adjourned.